Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the man some call the most polarizing and controversial Supreme Court justice in American history, the story of Antonin Scalia and why no one predicted who we would become. Then, how has music shaped politics historically and how is it changing politics today? U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's barbed remarks and offensive tactics have alienated even some of his conservative colleagues on the court. And many observers consider him the most polarizing justice in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Who is Antonin Scalia, and why did no one predict his behavior as a Supreme Court justice? With us is Bruce Allen Murphy. He is a judicial biographer and a professor of law at Lafayette College. His latest book is called Scalia, A Court of One. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Bruce Allen Murphy. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Maria. Thanks for inviting me.
Of all the justices, and I know you've been doing biographies of others as well, why Antonin Scalia specifically?
Well, it's been a journey to get to Scalia. This is my fourth judicial biography. The last one was on William O. Douglas, who was described by one of his friends, Raoul Berger, as the oddest duck who ever served on the Supreme Court. And the Douglas biography allowed me to explore the most controversial justice of that era, although he was, of course, an iconic liberal on the court. And I had been exploring through the other books on Brandeis and Frankfurter and Abe Fortas the issue of extrajudicial work by justices off the bench and the effect on the court. And when I looked for a new topic after Douglas, Scalia's name rose to the top very quickly because he's clearly the most visible, the most controversial, and possibly the smartest and most talented intellect on this court, a man who really would be fun to spend 8 years with exploring his life, and he was indeed all of that.
It's interesting you would use the word fun, given his sort of abrasive personality.
Well, you try not to get too emotionally involved with your subjects. And you hope that you pick a topic that will keep you getting out of bed in the morning and thinking, how can I advance this work a little bit farther? And I found Scalia endlessly fascinating. I kept discovering things about him that surprised me. I kept trying to predict what he would do next and trying to explain why my predictions weren't quite accurate. And he was an ideal subject for a biographer.
One of the things, speaking of prediction, is that hardly anybody could have predicted who he ended up becoming. And certainly in the early part of your book, you describe a guy who was affable. You describe a guy who, of course, liked to be the center of attention, but wasn't so offensive as he sort of turned out to be on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely true. When you do some of your preliminary research and biographical work, what you look for is journalistic pieces that cover the sweep of a person's life. If the individual is dead, then you start with the obituaries. If the individual is still living, you're going to start with the articles around the time when that person was put on the court. And I was puzzled almost immediately when I read a number of articles and a number of comments from people on all sides of the ideological spectrum, predicting that once Antonin Scalia was put on the Supreme Court in 1986 by Ronald Reagan, he would become the William Brennan of the conservatives. Brennan, of course, was the wingman to Earl Warren. He was the man who brought together the liberals into the activist Supreme Court, liberal court that the Warren Court became. And it was widely anticipated by everyone that Scalia, who was described as affable, gregarious, congenial, willing to compromise, willing to hear other views. These were the words that were used by these people, that he would bring the court together. And something didn't ring true, obviously, and I couldn't believe, one, that is the impression that they had in 1986. So I had to figure out from the early life, how did they get that impression? And I would have made the same prediction based on the evidence that they had in 1986. And then I had to figure out how he became who he is now.
Well, let's start to dissect that. He was an only child, and his parents were immigrants. Is that right?
It's true. And he was much more than an only child, if you can imagine that. He was the only child of his extended family's generation, which means he was also the only grandchild. So every member of his extended family, father and mother's side, doted on him. And he became used to that kind of attention, and I think it affected the way he saw the world. He was raised by an immigrant Italian father who was known as Sam Scalia. His name was actually Salvatore Eugene Scalia, a brilliant man who rose by his intellect to become a professor of Romance languages at Brooklyn College, was a very stern individual, and impressed on his son the need to be a person of considerable character. He would like to tell Antonin that muscles can be hired by the hour as an article of commerce, but character can't be sold or bought. And he was impressing upon his son the need for hard work, for scholastic effort, for academic achievement. And interestingly enough, he also had a theory called literalism. He believed that he could look at ancient Italian poets and interpret their meaning in English language by literally interpreting each of the words. So he had a theory that sort of previewed what Scalia would eventually do. And beyond that, his parents raised him in a pre-Vatican II, very traditional, very conservative Catholicism that has guided Scalia throughout his entire life.
It's a brand of Catholicism that doesn't really comport with what many Catholics hold, particularly the current pope.
And Scalia has gotten into debates with the Catholic Church in the early 21st century over the question of the death penalty. He would like to turn the clock back in the religious world to an earlier era, and he believes that the old values are the best values. When it turns out that he doesn't agree with the current pope, or when he doesn't agree with the current church, he argues, well, two millennia of popes agree with me, and so I choose to follow them rather than the current church and the current pope.
He was very conservative from very early on. He was an only child, and he didn't have to learn to play well with others. He did for a while, though.
He was capable of being very nice and playing as part of a team. He was actually a very accomplished actor when he was at Xavier High School, Jesuit school in Manhattan, and later at Georgetown University. He was a fellow that the other actors could rely on. He helped to get one of his fellow actors at Xavier through the role of playing Lady Macbeth, and the fellow was being teased, and he said Nino Scalia was able to help him through that as best he could. Scalia was a very well-liked. He was always elected to leadership positions, and in Georgetown, he was known as the actor Tony Scalia. That's the way he was billed in the playbills. But there was another side to him. It was true at Xavier and especially true at Georgetown. Scalia, from very early age, had an ability to see the central arguments in a debate, the jugular of the argument, if you will. And at the top levels, and Scalia was maybe the best college debater in the country of his era, the top college debaters are able to really crush their opponents, almost like an intellectual chess match, and they are not adverse to using ad hominem attack. It's expected. You're given additional points for that kind of a behavior. And that character on Georgetown's campus was known as Nino Scalia. So it was sort of a battle between these two sides, and I think that the person they were discussing in 1986 who would come to the court and bring the court together was Tony Scalia. And the person who arrived, as we'll learn down the road, is Nina Scalia.
So one became dominant later in life, whereas the other side may have been more dominant in the other parts of life.
And the one true constant in this period of his education was his pre-Vatican II Catholicism, even though he was at a Jesuit school at Georgetown. And because of his many accomplishments, he was asked to give effectively the valedictory speech. It was called the Cohonguraten speech, named for the Cohonguraten River, or the Potomac River, the River of Swans. And he made an argument that his classmates and he were the chosen few, that if they would not lead the country in the Catholic tradition, who would? And it was their obligation to be sure that others would follow in their footsteps.
That was kind of a common theme in your book, that even in his lectures as he became a professor, he ended them frequently with this idea that you cannot separate your religion from the rest of your life.
It's a constant theme throughout his own explanation of his life. That's why I opened the book with him at President Obama's second inaugural. And Claire McCaskill, who took a picture of him in his silk hat, his skull cap, in the 2008 inaugural, it was the first tweet, I think, that she made to her followers. She was waiting to see what he would wear to the second inaugural, and he showed up in this billowy sort of black velvet cap that looked almost like a popover. And when people found out where it had come from, it turned out to be a reproduction of the cap worn by Sir Thomas More, who is one of Scalia's heroes. Scalia believes that More was the saint of law, but also he is the depiction of the kind of morality and traditional Vatican, pre-Vatican II Catholicism that Scalia favors. And so when he ended his classes at the University of Chicago Law School, he would read his class, Selections from a Man for All Seasons, and encourage them to delve further into More's life.
Another common theme from your book is this idea that he didn't really want to engage in issues related to poor people. He thought that was a waste of his time, and he thought there were, in a quote that you have, more important things in life.
He's very much in line with meritocracy. He's not in favor of affirmative action. It's ironic for a man who was appointed to the court in the end by the president because he was an Italian-American. He de facto got an affirmative action hire for the Supreme Court. I think Scalia's belief is that you should pay attention to people who are achieving, and those people who are achieving will continue to be successful. Success will translate to financial reward. And so he's much more concerned about making it possible for those individuals to succeed rather than trying to create a country in which you do what you can to raise everybody up to a certain level so that they can achieve from that point.
Then he went to work for a big law firm doing defense work. Was it Jones Day?
Jones Day, which turned out to be pivotal in his life. He was working late at night as a law student on the Harvard Law Review, and a fellow from Jones Day in Cleveland went to the Law Review office looking for someone to hire and persuaded Scalia to at least come to Cleveland to visit for an interview. Scalia didn't get a job in Philadelphia or Boston or New York or Washington even, and he now says sometimes in his speeches, "Can you believe I went to Cleveland?" But it actually worked out for him. First of all, he got to be a generalist in the law, so he did all kinds of different cases and rose to the top very quickly. And a number of the people who were in that law firm became very well connected in the Republican Party, and so there was a fellow named Jonathan Rose who was able to get him appointments in the Nixon and the Ford administration. It was pivotal in Scalia's rise to power.
Let's go into some of this Nixon administration. First of all, rather than becoming a partner at Jones Day, he went on to teach instead. But then his colleagues went into the Nixon administration. How did he then end up going into the president's office?
Well, Scalia, I think, was a bit of a gypsy trying to figure out where he would end up. I think he played with the idea of being a private lawyer. I think he played with the idea of being an academic. Once he was at the University of Virginia, so close to be able to get on the train and go up to Washington, he was very interested in getting an appointment in Washington, somewhere where he could maybe be noticed and rise a little farther. Whether he at that point was thinking, well, gee, maybe one day I could be Solicitor General, or maybe one day I could be on the Supreme Court, I can't say, but at least he was trying to find his own place. He was exceedingly lucky in that he got his appointment to the Nixon administration just as the Nixon administration was going out of office. And Gerald Ford continued keep him in the administration. He was in the Office of Legal Counsel. And one of his first jobs was to figure out whether or not the presidential papers were owned by Richard Nixon and should be controlled by Richard Nixon. And he wrote an opinion in favor of Nixon's ownership. It was not an opinion that was followed by Congress. It was not an opinion that was followed by the Supreme Court. But interestingly enough, the only justice who dissented in that case in the Supreme Court was William Rehnquist, who was also in the Office of Legal Counsel. So Scalia had a gift for saying the right thing at the right time and a kind of a star over his head that put him in the perfect position each time for advancement to a better position.
So he did advance in both of those situations. Before he even ended up in the Office of General Counsel, didn't he also do some work in the broadcast field?
I skipped over that, and it was very interesting because it showed me how Scalia was learning how to work in the political field. He was working in the Office of Telecommunications Corporation. His job was to try to advise his boss about the questions of PBS funding and cable channels and exactly how regulations could work in the new cable industry when you already had broadcast television. And Scalia was well aware in this process that he was in opposition to the Nixon administration. The Nixon administration just wanted to defund PBS and was very unhappy about the national news of the PBS that was very hostile to Nixon's Watergate episode. And so what Scalia tried to do was advise his boss how politically to try to get around what the Nixon administration was trying to do and move the entire structure back to the local channels. And when that didn't seem to work, he was able to find the legal justification to allow his boss to make those arguments.
So throughout his work with both presidencies, he became really well-liked by two key people. One is Donald Rumsfeld, one is Dick Cheney.
You could count on Antonin Scalia to do what the Ford administration and what Gerald Ford needed to have done. And what I found especially interesting, he didn't do a lot of work directly with Cheney and Rumsfeld, but they were working on the same issues in different parts of the administration. Here were three men, one much younger than the other two, who had worked their entire professional careers to get to the White House to work with the president, and they were in a sinking administration, not through their own fault, not even through Gerald Ford's fault. This was a presidency as an institution that was greatly diminished by the Watergate episode. And so daily they were dealing with leaks to the press, and they were dealing with investigations by Congress. And I think it drove them all a little bit crazy that they had finally risen to this level of power, and they had no power. I think you find the roots there certainly of Scalia's affection for and determination to continue a much more powerful presidential office.
So you see this relationship, too, that develops between Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and Antonin Scalia from back in those days in a particular level of trust.
True, and it will go on for decades to come, and many years down the road in 2004 when Scalia goes duck hunting with Vice President Cheney at a time when the Vice President had a case before the Supreme Court dealing with his Energy Commission in the White House, Scalia is rather incredulous that people think that he should recuse himself, step down from that case, because he says, this is a friendship that I've had for so long, and so many other justices have had friendships with presidents. True enough, but they haven't had friendships with people who had cases then before the court.
You must wonder if one can be truly neutral in such cases.
Well, I don't think there was any doubt how he would come out in that case, but at least you have to have the appearance of propriety, and under that federal recusal rule that deals with whether or not a judge or a justice should step down, the standard is, would a reasonable person believe that you had an appearance of impropriety? And Scalia's argument in the 21-page memo was, if you think that I am improper here, you can't be reasonable, because no reasonable person that I know would think that this is an improper relationship.
Well, let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Bruce Allen Murphy, and we're talking about Scalia. That's the name of the book, Scalia, A Court of One, which is a rich biography about Antonin Scalia. While he was in the Nixon and Ford administration, a big part of his mission was derailing the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, and he had a real difficulty with all of the leaks and all of the information that was going to the press from the Ford administration. And I think he developed an antipathy to the notion of private secret information, administrative information in Washington, eventually being available to the public through these outlets. So he was always trying to find a way to undermine the Freedom of Information Act and make it impossible for anyone to get that kind of information. One of the unique things that he came up with was there were exemptions and ways that you could get around the administration saying, we're not going to make this information available to you, even though you followed congressional law. And one of the exemptions was if the White House said this is part of their working papers, then they need to keep that secret, sort of an executive privilege kind of situation. So Scalia came up with the idea of putting remote White House operations in all of the different agencies where people would be trying to get information, so that wherever you went for that information, you could say, oh, there's a White House operative there. I'm sorry, that information is in the exemption and you can't get it. You see this basic distrust of the press throughout Scalia's career. It's a curious relationship. He needs the press to be able to have them report on his speeches and report on his statements so that he can get the kind of attention that he's looking for. But he also keeps the press at arm's length and at times will exclude them from his activities because he can't control what they're going to say or do.
And it didn't seem like it was just the press, but any public information.
Yeah, he's not a fan of any public information, any secret information, any classified information getting out to the general public. He's very skeptical of the sort of democratic process by which people get transparency in their government so that they can vote the kinds of governors that they're seeking to get. He would much rather keep that information secret.
You wrote about how one of the people he fought was Ralph Nader at the time, and then he organized the CIA to help derail any advances with the Freedom of Information Act. Tell us what happened in these.
Well, he did. What he's trying to do, what Ralph Nader was trying to do, was get information on the Ford pardon of Richard Nixon. He wanted to know what kind of deal, if any, was made before Nixon left the White House. And what Scalia was doing there was opposing Ralph Nader, but also he was very skilled because of his earlier positions in the Nixon and Ford administration at knowing which people to call in which agencies to get the result that he wanted. And so he was able to give individuals in various agencies, defense agencies and the CIA, the kind of information that they needed to keep their documents secret in spite of the Freedom of Information Act, and also to organize amongst themselves and try to lobby the White House to get Gerald Ford to not sign off on the amendment that would change the Freedom of Information Act and open things up further.
Did you ever get a sense of what he was really afraid of in this process? Like, why didn't he believe in open government?
You know, I got the sense that he knew what his role was. I think the process that he was learning is the process that you see now on the court. You give me an issue, I will find the central part of that issue. I will figure out where I want to go, and then I will figure out what information I need to marshal in order to justify the result that I've already decided on. And that seemed to be what he was doing in all of these positions. He was learning bits and pieces of how to use the bureaucracy, how to use legal argumentation, how to use political argumentation, how to balance out all of the interests so that he could lead the president and the administration where they wanted to go. He was there to serve the president, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was in trouble. He was having trouble dealing with the press and Congress, and he was having trouble facing an election in 1976. His popularity continued to drop despite everything that he did because of what he had inherited from Richard Nixon. So I think Scalia is a very loyal individual, stayed until the very end of the Ford administration, even though it might have made it difficult for him to land in a different job. And in the process of trying to bolster the president, he learned how to be the Antonin Scalia we see now on the court.
President Carter comes into office. What does Antonin Scalia decide to do?
Well, very interesting, because what he decides to do is go out to Chicago. Most people, I think, would have stayed in Washington, and he flirted with that idea at Georgetown and being the law school. But he ended up going out to Chicago because he thought his money would stretch farther. He had a big family. They ended up living in an old fraternity house, and it would have given him a chance to figure out what to do next. So he had a foot in both worlds. He was teaching in Chicago, and he was also maintaining some of his connections in Washington. And as it turned out, it was another lucky turn in his life, because there were students out there who were beginning to put together what has become the Federalist Society. And they were working with a student at Yale where Robert Bork was teaching. And so you see sort of two camps that begin to arise, the Scalia camp among the conservatives and the Federalist Society, and then the Bork camp among the conservatives and the Federalist Society in Yale. And I think what happens is the beginnings of a sort of almost wariness and awareness that the next step in my career is going to have to be past Robert Bork, because Bork is better known at that point. He's been the Solicitor General. He was the man who fired Archibald Cox. He was the man who was mentioned for the seat that eventually went to John Paul Stevens. He's in the driver's seat for what will be a Supreme Court seat down the road. You want to get that seat, you've got to get past Robert Bork. And that leads us to his time on the Court of Appeals, where he gets to go side by side with Robert Bork.
He gets appointed to the appellate court, and he's still being an affable guy. He's starting to carve out his judicial theory here. We're starting to see it, but he worked well with the other side.
Generally, he did. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is a real proving ground for a Supreme Court appointment. It deals with a lot of administrative law appointments and a lot of law positions. And he was on a court in which the most visible judge in the federal system, Robert Bork, had been sitting for some time. He was more senior. He had been mentioned for the Supreme Court back in 1974. For Scalia, this became something of a proving ground. He did get along generally with the other members of that court. He did have his moments. He used to write and argue in cases so vehemently when he really truly believed in those issues that some of his work was called the Nino Path. What he was able to do was work within that system and position himself well against Robert Bork. All in all, this became sort of an intellectual judicial pose down for Scalia, using the term of bodybuilding. He was able to show the administration that he was younger, that he was in better health, and that he was a little better conservative and, they thought, more affable. He was able to get along with the other judges.
Bruce Allen Murphy, thank you so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure, Maria. I look forward to next week's conversation.
That is the first part of a two-part interview that we are doing with Bruce Allen Murphy about his new book, Scalia, A Court of One. We will continue the conversation next week. When we come back, how has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? Stay tuned.
Seven summits, and I swam the seven seas, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I fought in the jungles, and I fought in the streets, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. But once I had a reason, don't know what it could be, and the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I sang to myself that I want to be free, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. All over the world and throughout history, music has been a vital part of affecting social and political change. At times, the powers that be resist that change by oppressing music and the arts. How has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? We're joined by three experts. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. He's also author of Audiotopia, Music, Race, and America, and co-editor of the book series Refiguring American Music. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern History at University of California, Irvine. His books include Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, and Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Story of Islam's Generation X. Richard Flax is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author of Making History, The American Left and the American Mind, and Playing for Change, Music and Musicians in the Service of Social Movements. Dick Flax, I'm going to start with you to put this into a historic and political context with Woody Guthrie and also his fellow cohort of artists and how they have helped to shape American politics as we have it today.
Well, I would say more specifically, helped to shape American dissent or protest politics, social movements. That was the goal that Woody Guthrie and his colleagues, if you want to call them that, in the early years of the 1940s, late 1930s, set out to do. They had a project, which I think Woody, among others, described as taking traditional music rather than the popular mainstream music of the day and putting lyrics to that music that would deal with contemporary issues, and particularly in their day, the labor movement. And I think when you learn about them, then you can possibly think back for decades, back to the 19th century. The labor movement in this country, as well as other places, always had a strong musical dimension to it. And Woody and his people like Pete Seeger and others picked up that thread and tried to revitalize that at the time that I'm referring to. I think, though, that the main impact of that project politically really was in the 60s by what's been called the children and grandchildren of Woody Guthrie, Dylan most famously, who introduced this form of musical expression just when the mass movements of the 60s were emerging and helped to shape particularly the student movement, the youth revolt, the anti-war movement of the 60s through the songs that provide a shared identity, I think, for what ended up being millions of people, really.
So we have a shared identity. And then, Josh Kuhn, maybe this is the perfect place to bring you in, because you've looked at U.S. musical history as being intertwined with the history of race and ethnicity and identity. How do you see this interacting?
Well, I think that if you go back and you even just start with the very kind of foundations of the notion of America itself, the very kind of mythical promise of a democratic America, we see that song and music have long been central to debates around that. And the most obvious place to look there, of course, is in the music of slaves and in the sorrow songs of newly arrived Africans and African Americans in the United States, where music might not have sounded political, might not have announced itself as a protest song in the way that we just heard in the 1960s, it really took shape in that way. But in the early days, of course, when we're talking about sorrow songs and slave songs, you're talking about music that had codes, music that didn't announce itself as overtly protest or oppositional, but served a political function. And I think throughout the history of the very notion of America, the history of the United States itself, music has always been a site for struggle around the meanings of freedom and liberty. And that's still the case to this very day.
Mark Levine, you've argued in your work that music is a better way of understanding culture and societies, particularly in the Middle East, than are many other means. Why do you say that?
Well, there's several reasons. First of all, music is one of the oldest and most profound cultural expressions, and so many other aspects of culture come through it. So, for example, prayer and religious performance is very often traditionally expressed musically. Certainly, in the Middle East, there's a very old tradition of protest poetry and then music, you know, going back at least into the 30s, 40s, 50s. You see this naturally in the protests, whether in Tahrir Square in Cairo or in Abu Dhabi, and so much music just naturally exploding from there. Or in Tunisia or in Syria, where at least one of the major poet singers there was brutally murdered. And in Morocco, another one is in jail, you know, on potentially trumped up politicized charges a rapper. It's also a way of seeing commonalities. I think so much of the problem when Americans look at other cultures, especially the Middle East, where we have so many conflicts and so many misunderstandings, music is a way of seeing the commonalities between the struggles everyone shares. And I think when you see the, you know, really strong influence, let's say, the early 2010-11 revolts had on the Occupy movement in Europe and the U.S., you can see how, especially through music and through poetry and through this artistic expression, they were able to create solidarities between movements in different countries that otherwise would have been much harder to have.
You bring up another important point, which is the oppression of the arts as a means of maybe oppressing a certain kind of communication or a solidarity. Tell us a little bit about this oppression that you've seen.
I don't want to overemphasize, as some people have done, but one of the causal factors in the explosion of protests in Tunisia was the jailing of this one rapper, El General, who wrote a song called Rais Le Bled, President of the Country, where he was, you know, really just begging the president at that point, Ben Ali, to just understand the cost of his policies and his avarice and greed and violence on a generation. And when he was arrested, young people came out in even bigger numbers to protest his jailing. And that was the first symbol that you can use a music that is specifically related to the generation that's revolting as a means of communicating. You know, Chuck D, Public Enemy, famously said that hip-hop was the CNN of the street of Black America, essentially. And this is exactly what this music became in the Middle East, whether it was hip-hop or for 2 decades before that, music like heavy metal and other so-called Western genres, hardcore punk, were used by young people to express their anger and frustration at a system from which they were severely marginalized. And this has continued. If you look at Egypt, the quote-unquote singer of the revolution, Rami Hassan, was grabbed off the street and severely tortured by the Egyptian authorities in the wake of the Egyptian revolution when they next had protests, I think, March of 2011. And just all across the board, wherever there's been these revolts in the Arab world of the last 2 years, musicians and also other types of artists have been at the forefront, and governments have gone after them because of that, because they understand that they're able to communicate in a means that the governments can't compete with. And they can reach people, especially with the internet, but also through live performances and bringing people together in a way that governments can't do. And I'll just give you one example from the last time I was in Egypt with Rami Hassan. He was performing at a major protest, tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square, and there was all this conflict between the Salafis, or the ultra-religious, and the secular forces. And when he came on the stage, he brought with him a huge number of these ultra-soccer fans who had been so crucial to the revolution, at least on the streets and the fighting. And they barreled through all the Salafis to establish a presence there. But once he started playing, you can see Salafis coming and sort of drifting over and listening to the music and nodding their head to his songs, because his songs ultimately were about freedom and against the government and reflected exactly what they were feeling. So even though from an orthodox religious perspective they maybe should not have been listening to it, they couldn't help but listen to it. And for that moment, at least, the Salafis and the ultras suddenly understood, and they were in the same space and seeing they had a common enemy, which was the government and the military. And that's precisely the kind of thing that music can do that almost no other art form can do.
Josh Kuhn, talk about what you've seen in Mexico.
In Mexico, in some ways similar to the things that Mark was describing in the Middle East, during the election year, the growing student movement, Yo Soy 132, the Yo Soy 132 student movement, was a movement that actually, when it started, didn't have much music at its core, but gradually music became a central part of how students were organizing themselves and not only expressing their political views in opposition to the right-wing political parties in Mexico, but how they were actually using music as a way to figure out community, as a way to figure out what their ideas were. So I guess what I find really interesting is both how music can be a direct form of expression, as Mark was talking about it, but also can be the very kind of ground for the building of a community that allows that expression to happen. In Mexico, we've been seeing that all over the place, where music has been in marches, but also been a way for students to just have an excuse to get together, to write songs together, to formulate and rehearse ideas that then enter into a larger kind of public debate.
I can recall a time in Chile post-coup that the particular kind of music was banned, and yet people would sneak it on the air on the sly. But soft oppression that we've had here in the U.S. during the McCarthy era and even post-9/11, Dick Flax, could you speak to that?
Well, we do have some great stories of the martyrdom of troubadours in this country. One example before the time you're mentioning was Joe Hill, who was the sort of supreme songwriter of the industrial workers of the world, the wobbly revolutionary labor movement in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. He was tried and executed for murder in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1915, a funeral with 100,000 people in Chicago after his execution. The big McCarthy moment people remember in terms of music was Pete Seeger. He was called before the Un-American Activities Committee. He was one of many entertainers, of course, who experienced that, but Pete took the stance that he would not respond to their questions because the government had no right to ask the questions. And that led to a contempt citation by Congress. He faced a year in jail, but he ultimately won his court case. But that certainly added to the definition of him as a figure of protest and a symbol of strong dissent during that particular period. I'm not sure that repression is the main story in the United States about the uses of music, but I think what we've heard already is that any time you have this kind of musical development, and particularly the emergence of sort of troubadours with a kind of heroic quality to them, they often become targets for the regime, and that move on the part of the regime that's feeling itself threatened can backfire badly. The big moment of supreme repression of music was the torture and execution of Victor Jara, the great troubadour of the Chilean protest in the early 70s. His death really has stayed as a kind of symbol for decades after that globally of the power of song, I guess, and of almost Christ-like figure that emerges from music in many, many parts of the world. It's quite amazing how troubadours can take on that symbolic value for large numbers of people. And the effort to suppress them, as has been said, is very dangerous because it's in the mass popular consciousness and a shared feeling that this music has reached. So when you start to repress it, people who might otherwise not be sure of their politics begin to see this as the true nature of the regime, the repression.
Josh Kuhn, you have looked at Gil Scott-Heron saying music being a melodic form of guerrilla warfare.
This is in the context of a kind of larger examination of the role of music in the Black Power movement. And what's interesting about that quote from Scott-Heron is he both was talking about songs that lyrically were staging a protest, but also just the way that, let's say, in an instrumental piece, I believe the original context for that was that when he was a young boy in music school, the idea that he would play classical music on a piano when his teacher wasn't in the room and make changes to the pieces that he was playing, that was his own form of protest. And so I think it's equally important, as Mark was signaling a bit earlier, that, you know, lyrics clearly are what we so often focus on with good reason, but also in instrumental songs, just the choice of style, Western pieces versus Eastern pieces, songs that sound quote-unquote too Black, too Mexican, too Jewish, songs that disrupt the kind of dominant sonic racial order. Throughout time, just the sound of something can be disruptive enough to cause protest, to cause debate, to cause change. And so I think part of what he was getting at there is that the choices that we make as listeners, the choices that we make as musicians, the music we choose to play and how we choose to play it are aesthetic choices that have social impact.
Mark Levine, let's bring you in on that. Is that what you're seeing also in these changing areas in the Middle East?
I think certainly music is helping to break down boundaries, absolutely. I guess we could also think of Fela Kuti, who said music is the weapon of the future. I think his last album was named that, and he was someone who knew a lot about regime oppression. They literally threw his mother out the window of his house and killed her because of his political activities. If people look at this organization, Free Muse, a Danish organization that is basically the Amnesty International for musicians, it's amazing how many musicians around the world right now are suffering severely, whether censored, repression, torture, jail, or murdered, are assassinated for their activities and their music. What I think is clear is that music on its own can't do it, but it's very hard to spread revolution without a cultural marker that can grab people together. You know, music is not a sufficient condition. You know, you can have revolutionary music and not have the revolution. But it's hard to think of revolutions that didn't have some kind of musical component that wasn't just expressing what was already there, but expressing it in a way that amplified it. And I think great music does two things. It amplifies, so it takes what everyone is saying and it boils it down to the most powerful elements and then sends it out even louder. But it also is a kind of prism. It also refracts and breaks apart dominant ideologies and makes it easier to critique or to take what you already, you know, to use, let's say, the idea of Gramsci about common sense versus good sense. Great revolutionary music would take everyone's common sense and turn it into good sense, and that what everyone sort of knows will become something that they can trust their ears. Now, they can trust that what they're suspecting is true, but they can also act on it, and it gives you, you know, both hope and possibility. At least in the music I've been following in the Arab world the last 2 years, that's really what makes it so special. And I think when you look at Woody Guthrie, of course, or any of the great protest movement, Pete Seeger, or for that matter, Public Enemy, or even after 9/11, I think at one point there were over 100 hip-hop songs that have been written in protest against the post-9/11 militarization of American politics that, unless you were listening to KPFK or something, you probably didn't hear. But the artists were out there, and there were these sub-communities, and they were being heard. In all these places, there's still pockets where music is at the forefront and is carrying the torch, so to speak, to keep things lit. And again, I don't want to say that music is more powerful than, let's say, a play or a poem or a piece of graffiti, but out of all those, it's the only one that you can join in on, right? You can read a poem, but you're not going to join, but that's not a communal experience. You can go see a piece of graffiti. You can go see a play. You can watch a movie. You can read a book. But music's the only one where you can gather around with everyone and all do the art together. And that's what I think makes it a uniquely powerful medium for protesting and then transcending.
Dick Flax, let me add to that, because I think that's a very important point. There is something unique about singing as an art form, and I think you put your finger on a good part of it, the idea of gathering around. And as Seeger has tried to show, singing together is a very empowering experience. All religions know that, of course. National anthems sung together, but social movements. What I wanted to add was that it's a unique art form because you don't need an artist in a specialized sense to create or reproduce the song. The song becomes everybody's property. You can sing the song yourself without any talent or trained capacity as a musician. You keep it in your consciousness. It's part of your being in a way that I don't think there's any other art form that can quite do this. Yip Harburg, who was a great political Broadway lyricist, he said a song is the unique way in which thought and feeling are fused, which I think is another part of trying to define why this is a particularly important political means of expression. So it's the bringing together of people. It's the creation of some sense of empowerment when people are singing together. It's the combination of ideas and emotion in a fused way. And there are many different functions of particular songs. Some are these collective empowerments. Some are songs that have ideas that you, the creator of the song, are trying to convey to others. And there's therefore very complicated songs as well as very chant-like songs. One of the great protest songs was Give Peace a Chance by John Lennon. Great because everyone could sing it in mass rallies at the end of the war. Protest movement, millions of people were singing this together. So it was a brilliant invention by Lennon of the most simple idea of how a song can work for empowerment purposes.
This is Josh Kuhn. I think the idea of music as a mode of public gathering and of bringing people together to sing together, to join voices, to raise voices in unison is obviously a very, very important point. And I just want to add to that, though, is that there's also the other aspect, which is the non-public part of music, which is to say the power of being able to listen to a recording in private, in your bedroom, on headphones, actually outside of the public gaze, so that you can retreat to a kind of sense of private refuge to use music as a way to imagine worlds that you didn't think were actually possible, or worlds that were being actively being shut down in front of your very eyes and ears. So that, for me, part of what makes music so singularly special, I think, in many ways, as a political tool, is how it keys into a broader sense of what politics are. This idea that music can allow you to imagine worlds that you didn't think were otherwise going to be possible. And often we need to be alone and in private for that to happen.
A few other aspects of this that I think about in today's music world, particularly in the United States, and it's something that Mark Levine, you mentioned, which is oftentimes these really great music doesn't get heard, particularly in a consolidated radio world where there's not very much exploration of things that veer outside of what the establishment sees as commercial. And so I wonder if music can still play this role in the U.S. if they're A, not hearing some of this great music, but B, if they're misunderstanding some of it.
Dick Flex, I've been really preoccupied with that question for quite a while now. Radio is no longer the framework, even though I also have my own radio show, where most people, I think younger people particularly, are getting awareness of music. You just go to YouTube and look for certain musicians, you'd be quite amazed by how many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have made hits on various things that you may not have heard in any other context. So I'm not sure we know all that much about how people are getting access to cultural forms, musical forms, song and performances now, but it's the opportunity for people to hear about this far transcends what radio was ever able to bring to people or what CDs are able to bring to people. And it's hard to even know what the channels of communication are among people, young people in particular, that lead them to find out about these kinds of things online and find them. But there are hundreds and hundreds of people writing songs now coming out of the Occupy movement. There just was a 4-CD album released with 99 Occupy songs. That's a lot of songs, but there's still more of them if you go to YouTube or other, just go online and look for them. I don't know what people who are producing these songs think their fate will be. It seems like people want to get their performances out there. It's cheap and technologically very feasible now to do it, so people are doing it. And whether a particular song is shared by a lot of people and known by a lot of people is one sort of question which may be hard to answer from this great Tower of Babel of music that is now out there. But certainly the creativity is happening, and I think when people are in mass protests like the Occupy types of protests, they're bound to be coming up with songs or sharing songs. And some of the major performers, Tom Morello is one of the best examples, has been going around a lot in the old Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger way to these rallies and singing and creating these songs that can be sung by people in that context.
I think that's a really great point, Mark Levine. And I think the sad part is Morello is one of the few people who's doing this on a regular basis. What's actually shocking to me in the U.S. context is how completely all these major supposedly liberal performers who, you know, will give you a benefit for Obama, you didn't see them in Wisconsin the way you'd see Morello and one or two other people. And that's something I think in America that's really sad, that how divorced even people like Springsteen and others, who at one point were much more politically active, have become from being out there with their music on the grassroots. They might do a big song like U2 might do a song about Iran when they had the protests after the 2009 election, but they're not doing anything that's actually putting themselves on the line.
Well, you know, I would like not to make such a sweeping generalization, because if you take Springsteen himself, not only did he put out his most political album, which is very related to the Occupy movement, but I've seen, if you go to YouTube and see some of his performances, they're very much embracing in these large mass concert venues the movement.
Yeah.
He hasn't necessarily gone to...
I certainly agree with you there, but I guess for me, coming from the Middle Eastern context, I think there's something crucial about being at the site.
Oh, I agree with that.
Creating the community there. Yes, absolutely agree. It's last, you know, very political, but I think it's very crucial for people to to be with the people protesting because it brings more people down, and it helps create the numbers. And I'm not sure why, for the most part, most of the big name so-called liberal artists or progressive artists have not really made it a point of making Occupy their own, because had they done that, I think they would have helped sustain this movement after that initial burst inevitably was going to die down. And, you know, Morello can't be everywhere, right? And there needs to be other people. And just when you have musicians, for example, in Bahrain or in Morocco or others, when the musicians are willing to go out and sacrifice themselves either by being arrested or being on the front lines or being hosed down or even worse, beaten, this, in a way, really motivates so many other people to do the same thing. And somehow in America, we've been so far removed, even our musical elite, from being willing to do that, that it really makes it much harder for the music that we do have to have the kind of political impact that it might otherwise have, at least in my opinion.
I think that one other thing that's important to mention here, though, is, of course, if we look at the biggest civil rights marches in the history of the United States, which happened in 2006 and 2007, pro-immigration marches that gathered millions and millions and millions of people across the country, you saw bands marching. Now, these were bands that many people aren't talking about in the English-speaking world, but in the Spanish-speaking world of the United States, specifically in the context of Mexican immigration and Mexican migrancy in the United States, bands singing in Spanish, who are commercially popular bands, are at the same time on the front lines of these marches and are the musical voices of migrant Mexican America. And I think that it's really, really important when we're talking about America, in quotes, that we're also talking about and thinking about multilingual music here, and especially not leaving out the central role that Spanish language music is playing in the United States right now in shaping all kinds of debates around immigration, immigration and migrancy and all these other questions.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. And let me thank you all so much for this wonderful discussion. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern history at University of California, Irvine. Richard Flax is emeritus professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I was walking, I saw a sign there.